Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with geographer Richard Campanella about his new book, Bourbon Street, A History. We'll also hear from Blake Bailey, whose new memoir is The Splendid Things We Planned, A Family Portrait. Richard Campanella is a geographer and professor of practice in the Tulane University School of Architecture. He's a geographer who's taught us to read the New Orleans landscape more closely and more skillfully in such books as New Orleans Then and Now, Time and Place in New Orleans, Geographies of New Orleans, Urban Fabrics Before the Storm, Bienville's Dilemma, An Historical Geography of New Orleans, and Lincoln in New Orleans. Now he's back with an examination of our most celebrated and notorious thoroughfare in Bourbon Street, A History. I always love to talk with Rich because his insights into our city are so extraordinary and thought-provoking. I learn something every time we meet. Richard Campanella, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
Now, if anyone could tell the story of a single street in such detail, it could only be you, really.
Well, the phenomena that this particular street offers for interpretation spans the entire spectrum and the full 300 years. And this is really the first full-length, in-depth history of Bourbon Street of the full three centuries, from as a kind of a cultural artifact, but also its physical, its built environment, its physical mm-hmm. geography.
Now, one of the things that's so interesting to me is that there are certain stereotypical ways we think about Bourbon Street. It has certain associations. And you talk about how you fell prey to those associations, that it wasn't something serious to study. And then Katrina changed all that for you.
I came to realize what a mistake that was, to dismiss it as this silly, empty metaphor. I've always been curious as to where did this come from? Where did this phenomena come from? And why there? You know, the fundamental geographical question of explaining location. Why not some other street? Why not Dauphine or Royal? And I went through the same cycle that many people do of being curious about it, but then being dismissive of it. And one moment that really changed my opinion was the realization, right immediately after Katrina, even during Katrina, that this was the one place that demonstrated that the human heart was still beating in this city. I'm speaking of the days right after the storm, at the absolute nadir of this city's history, when a couple of bars remained open, a couple of clubs soon reopened, a few musicians and buskers played in the streets, and it gave something for the cameras to focus on, other than this catastrophe and this death and dying, that began to change the subject. And to be sure, later that month, it was the first space to come back. It was the first one to bring back jobs. It was the first space to send tax dollars back to City Hall coffers.
Well, you wouldn't think a few stubborn bars and nightclubs could pique a scholar's interest that would go on for so long, but that's a happy result, isn't it?
Yes. You know?
Now, after that revelation, you went back to the very beginnings of Bourbon Street, right back to its very placement on the earth of New Orleans, as it were. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the choices that people made in locating Bourbon Street.
Well, for one thing, Bienville was not the one who designed and laid out the street grid. It was Adrien Desposes and Leblanc de la Tour a few years later. But what Bienville did do is draw the very first straight line on this deltaic landscape. And state lines are a complete anomaly to nature. There are no straight lines in nature. There are no 90-degree angles. And Pauger, a few years later, recognized where Bienville had laid this line. It's actually between Charters and Royal, and it runs through the rear of what is now the rear of St. Louis Cathedral. And Bienville's original intent was that the city would later be aligned to that such that that would have been Decatur Street. So what Poggia did was he realized that we're wasting all this high ground closer to the river. You get the breezes there, that's where the action is going to be. So he moved up his grid to where it is currently. And so in part, as a result of this, the French Quarter evaded just about every major flood in the city's history because he gained that advantage. And of course, this brought Bourbon Street with it.
Absolutely. Now, the last time you and I spoke, you talked about this major discovery you had made in the course of your writing, and you said that you had discovered people. And there are
who knew
there were people out there? And you have so many colorful characters in this book. This is a book that's just filled with fascinating New Orleanians. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that discovery and the people you met along the way.
Sure. And I would note that the book is still fundamentally a cultural geography. It's mm-hmm. about space and place and human distributions and the why behind the where. And one of the transformations, many readers are familiar with some of my previous books, such as Geographies of New Orleans. What I went through there, it was humanity in the abstract. Humanity as depicted through thousands and thousands of census data and residential settlement patterns and ethnic groups and class groups and city directories, methodologies, and mapping out these patterns. And one of the transformations that I went through when I started Lincoln in New Orleans on Lincoln's flatboat trips down here was that it was still about geography. But I told it through the eyes of this incredible young man, future president. He served as sort of this historical docent, if you will, taking me and my readers down this journey of this flatboat industry of young men coming down the Mississippi, experiencing New Orleans, taking that experience back with them. And I started to work on this notion of geography through biography, of telling stories of spatial patterns and the emergence of cityscapes through the eyes of actual human beings. And so the Bourbon Street story lends itself with all of this cast of characters, most of them locals, working class, who never had a plan, never had a vision. And it's a case of emergent bottom-up order rather than a top-down invented phenomena.
I know. That's one of the things I love the most that you point out, that this entity has survived just on kind of collective goodwill and adaptation and improvisation in a way, always changing to the times.
And constant civic battles.
Yes, that too. Noise,
going
noise
on
ordinance.
To this day, to this night.
But tell us about some of the colorful people. I love the people you write about.
Well, for one, Gaspar Gulata, who was known as the little mayor of Bourbon Street, born of Sicilian immigrants who arrived to the sugar parishes like so many others as replacement for enslaved labor in the postbellum era. Urbanized, and he and his brother, who was a prize fighter, also ran a bar nearby, worked their way up, and he became a real key character between the 1930s and the 1950s. He was the go-to guy to settle scores, to make peace between anti-vice reformers and City Hall and what I call the Bourbonites,
the Bourbonites.
Club owners and the bar owners. And when he died, one of his pallbearers was Chet Morrison, the mayor, the so-called reform mayor.
Amazing.
And the lack of individuals like Gaspar Gulata, who was able to work between both worlds there, set up a situation in the early 1960s that proved to be a turning point and kind of the end of the golden age of mid-century Bourbon Street.
Now, in the midsection of the book, Fame and Infamy, you chart six phases of this street: germinating, blossoming, flourishing, exploding, degenerating, and finally stabilizing. And that's an amazing arc for any kind of story, don't you think? It's just
yes,
stunning.
And my formulations of those chapters, that they've become chapters, speaks to my original title for the book, which was How Bourbon Street Happened.
Uh-huh.
And it did, it happened. It organically sprang up, bottom up, but there was rhyme and reason. And I have another chapter explaining why here, Why not some other street? And, you know, you could draw analogies between, you know, in agriculture or when you're planting something, that you need fertile soil, but you also need a moment of germination. And so I explained these various larger urban geographical factors that presented this as an ideal space for this postbellum transformation when nocturnal entertainment started to gravitate to the inner city. And some of the seeding moments would have been things like the French Opera House and the emergence of concert saloons, kino halls. Gambling is a big part of this picture. And then finally, the nightclub.
I love those. I love that chapter. And then, too, you talk about the vicissitudes of war and how the Great War, Prohibition, World War II, those all had such impact on Bourbon Street.
And they did so by bringing Bourbon's favorite client to the city, and that is young males out on their own for a night on the town. It almost came into the present form during World War I because this was a port of embarkation and there were hundreds of thousands of young guys in town. What tripped it up was Prohibition. Once the Roaring Twenties gave it new life despite Prohibition, then came the Great Depression. It tripped it up once again. Then came World War II, which brought in probably millions on R&R from surrounding training camps, etc. And what changed then is that Bourbon kept the momentum after World War II, whereas similar spaces in other cities boomed, these kind of nocturnal entertainment, mm-hmm. They boomed during the war, but then they flatlined afterwards. Bourbon Street kept that momentum going, and that's why we have the phenomenon we have today. It comes out of World War II.
And the street's wicked reputation, you write, is something that the city actually burnished and worked toward and accepted and was proud of.
Right. And when you know, I have a section on antecedents of Bourbons, we had Bourbon Streets before. They were in different spaces, but their spaces had rhyme and reason. And believe me, they were a whole lot more dangerous than Bourbon Street is today. Gallatin Street.
That's so famous.
Yes, the Swamp. O'Keefe, of all places, it was called Philippa at the time. But O'Keefe in the rear of the CBD would have been at the edges of the back of town, coming around Girard Street, which connected with the Flatboat Wharf, and then Franklin and Iberville, which was called Custom House. Mm-hmm. So if you just map out these antebellum vice spaces I just described, they were on the periphery of the antebellum city. And so what changed after the Civil War is that those areas started to residentially develop and that industry moved into the inner core. Then along comes Storyville, and then that closure brings it into the Tango Belt, and a number of raids on the Tango Belt allow Bourbon to grab the advantage, and that's in the 1920s. And then World War II just catalyzes it later on.
Now, would you dare to imagine the future of Bourbon Street? Or do you just see
well,
change?
Well, you know, the note I end on is one of the stabilization that came out of the 1980s to the present. And it took a lot of work to stabilize it from its downward descent in the early 60s and 70s. And Mayor Moon Landrieu's task force in the 1970s did a lot to see that. In a city whose future is very hard to predict, Bourbon Streets is probably quite easy to predict. And I foresee this stabilization to continue such that the experience you'll have there 20 years from now will be fairly similar to one now, with new cultural innovations that get tested elsewhere. And once Bourbon Street sees that they're successful, they adopt it.
There will be apps, don't you think?
There will be apps.
We've been talking with Richard Campanella, whose fascinating new book is Bourbon Street, A History. You can meet him Thursday, March 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. And you can also see him at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, Sunday, March 23rd at 1, at a panel celebrating the best of Louisiana cultural vistas. For more information, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. Thank you so much, Rich.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Blake Bailey is an award-winning, critically acclaimed biographer of American writers, numbering John Cheever, Richard Yates, and Charles Jackson among his subjects. His current work in progress is the authorized biography of Philip Roth. But for a moment in his writing career, he turned his attention to his own life in a memoir called The Splendid Things We Planned, A Family Portrait. Blake is speaking to us from his home in Virginia, where he is the Minna Hohenberg Darden Professor of Creative Writing at Old Dominion University. Blake is also a former New Orleanian and one of the featured guests at this year's Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Blake, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks, Susan. It's great to be here.
You've had such a distinguished career as a literary scholar, but I should confess that you were my daughter's English teacher at Lusher back in the day. So I'm especially glad to talk to you and say I knew you when.
Those were great days. I remember Casey, as you know, with a great deal of fondness. She was one reason of many that was a wonderful gig.
Now, I'm sure that this, The Splendid Things We Planned, was the most difficult book you've ever written, and you said that it took you 11 years. What made you decide the time was right for it? And tell us a little bit about why it was so difficult.
Well, it's very different writing a biography and writing a memoir, as I discovered, because to be a good biographer, you have to be an empiricist. You have to keep your head clear of all the preconceptions about your subject until you've gathered all the evidence. Bad biographers, what they have in common is they all have axes to grind, like Elvis is, of course, drug-addled hillbilly, that's Albert Goldman, or, you know, Frank Sinatra or Oprah or Nancy Reagan are all essentially evil, that's Kitty Kelly. So whatever evidence doesn't support their preconceived thesis is either downplayed or rejected outright, and as a memoirist, or anyway, as this memoirist, you go in with all the baggage of a bad biographer. Because when I first started making notes for this book about 11 years ago, as you point out, I basically brainstormed a list of all the biggest catastrophes of my brother's life, because this is going to be the story of a willfully self-destructive person. And I wrote that book, and who cares? You know from page one that Scott is going to go down the tube, and it was very much of a, you know, and then this happens, and this, and then, and then, and then. But a person doesn't destroy himself in a vacuum, and it occurred to me that I was writing almost entirely about the later Scott, the Scott who had come to dominate my memory, since he'd been in a bad way for most of our adult lives. And what I'd forgotten was the often loving and charismatic and handsome young man that Scott had been, really far more promising than I in most ways when we were children. So I thought a lot more about that Scott and the various ways, you know, that I had failed him rather than vice versa, and the way our parents had failed both of us and vice versa, and really just how ghastly it had been for all four of us individually, not because we didn't love each other, but because we were very different people who wanted very different things out of life. And in our midst was this person who was, for whatever reason, hardwired to self-destruct, and that was like setting off a bomb in the midst of an already chaotic situation. So long story short, the book I ultimately produced 11 years later was almost as much about me and my failings as it was about Scott and the others, and I think it's a much, much better book.
You are pretty unsparing of yourself in this book, I think. It is about your failings as well, and about the change in your life when you fell in love, got married, began your own family.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. You know, another interviewer asked me what turned it around for me, and I really couldn't come up with a better answer than I met a nice woman. And I think that's often the case.
I think so, too. But what made you decide that the time was right for a memoir in your own life? Why now? Why not later? And how did you even know it was finished?
Spoiler alert, first of all. When I first started writing this book 11 years ago, my brother was still alive, dead now. But I knew I wouldn't see him again. And the end was pretty much inside. And I was grieving about it. So this was kind of a therapeutic exercise to kind of trace back and find out how things had gone so wrong. And also, I was between books, and I needed to work on something, so it made sense to work on this.
Now, tell us about the title, which comes from Roy Clark's Yesterday When I Was Young. It's such a lovely title.
Yes, that is from a French song that Roy Clark sang the English version of, and it's about a person who realizes that their youth is over and that they wasted their life, and that a sort of empty wasteland awaits them because they've sort of frittled away every good opportunity they ever had. The reason it's particularly appropriate in this case is my brother enlisted in the Marines when he was in his late 20s, and we all thought it was an almost miraculous turnaround. For a while, he did really well, and he got his own radio program, and he sent me a tape of what he thought was one of the better shows. It was a New Year's Eve broadcast, and at one point he said, "This song is kind of corny, but it's got a poignancy for this time of year." And I heard that song, and I thought, wow. And it was ominous, because we thought at the time, again, that Scott was sort of on the comeback trail, which proved not to be the case.
You know, they say that every book teaches the writer how to write it. What did you learn about yourself by doing this?
What I learned about myself was not very pretty, really. I'm estranged from my father, who I used to be very close to, and that's largely because I could never get along with my stepmother. That's another story, part of which is in the memoir. But I understood better, writing this book, why my father just became exasperated with the whole situation, and I was very much a part of that situation, and why I was so exasperating. Writing this book, the process of it was an excruciating exercise in learning my own shortcomings as a human being. But that said, I think that I also gave myself all the more credit for having a certain resilience in surviving all this, because if anything, it made me reflect just how ghastly and untenable our family situation was.
Did it teach you anything, or, I mean, did it illuminate for you your other writing choices, like why you'd chosen the subjects you'd chosen to write about?
Well, that's what everyone's going to say. That's what Janet Maslin said in her review yesterday. Now we know. I wonder, the opening sentence of hers was that I've now written 4 books about families with literary talent that are sort of doomed by alcohol trouble, because I've written about John Cheever and Richard Yates and Charles Jackson, and they were all ruinous alcoholics. And I am fascinated by addicts and alcoholics, and partly because that's in my own background, and it, of course, ruined my brother's life. But it's not enough to say that it interests me that people drink a lot and sort of destroy themselves. I'm interested in the compartmentalized psyche of the addict, how they negotiate their inner life and the sort of persona that they present to the outer world. That's fascinating to me. And also, you know, addicts and alcoholics tend to have sort of, until they don't, tend to have sort of a lovely and interesting inner life. That's how they entertain themselves. That's what they cultivate.
And you also write with great compassion about how much they managed to achieve despite that.
Yes.
You know,
I mean, again, making a living as a writer of fiction, particularly in the case of Cheever and Yates and Charles Jackson, is just a nutty way to, it's a crazy livelihood. And you've got to be really driven by something terrible to persevere in that.
Now, one thing I did want to ask you, this isn't the first time that you've turned your attention to yourself and your family life. You and your then young family moved back to New Orleans in the summer of 2005, right before Katrina, and you chronicled your life post-Katrina in a series of articles for Slate called My Year of Hurricanes. That was really an amazing series that you did there a long time ago about your own life.
Yeah, that was an interesting episode in my life. You know,
yeah.
I went to Tulane, and I spent most of my adult life in New Orleans. I met my wife in New Orleans, but we had left because Mary was in her doctoral program at the University of Florida. Then, by a complete fluke, the details of which I'll spare you, she was assigned to Tulane for her doctoral internship. And that's, you know, irrefutable. Your match is like a medical residency.
Right.
Matched by a computer, and you have to go where you're matched. So we discussed, it's only for a year, and we thought we should just rent a place and then leave. But we had a one-year-old daughter, and my mother-in-law still lived in New Orleans, and we needed help because we both worked. So we bought a house. We moved into the house in June 2005. We loved the house, and we lived there for just over 2 months, and it was completely destroyed by Katrina.
And you really captured all the feelings that everybody felt at that time. It was just, that was harrowing too, wasn't it, when you think about it?
It was harrowing. You know, I got a certain amount of grief because I make it clear in the Slate pieces that I wasn't going to come back.
Right.
And people said that I was sort of betraying New New Orleans and so forth. Well, I was kind of a short-timer there anyway, and I loved New Orleans, but I've done that, and I couldn't rebuild that house, and it was just, it was too much.
Yeah. Well, we're glad you're going to come back for the Tennessee Williams Festival this year.
I can't wait.
It'll be fun.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people I want to see.
We've been talking with biographer and memoirist Blake Bailey. His new book is The Amazing, The Splendid Things We Planned, A Family Portrait. You can meet him at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, March 21st at 2:30, when he appears on the panel, Unexamined Life, Mysteries of Memoir. And again, Saturday, March 22nd at 10 on a biographer's panel, Whose Life Is It Anyway? For more information, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. Thank you so much, Blake.
Thank you, Susan. It was fun.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Anne Benoit discusses and signs New Orleans Best Ethnic Restaurants Tuesday, March 11th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The First Tuesday Book Club, make that the Second Tuesday Book Club this month, discusses Rachel Kushner's The Flamethrowers, Tuesday, March 11th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop. Kim Harrison reads from and signs The Undead Pool, Tuesday, March 11th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Deborah Burst signs Hallowed Halls of Greater New Orleans, Historic Churches, Cathedrals, and Sanctuaries at Author Night, Tuesday, March 11th at 6:30 at Hubble Library. Chelsea Johnson is the featured reader for the 1718 Society's March Reading, Tuesday, March 11th at 7 at the Collins Hotel on St. Charles Avenue. S. Frederick Starr signs Last Enlightenment, Wednesday, March 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Michael Murphy signs Eat Dat, Wednesday, March 12th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop, along with Jeremy Labadie and Argyle Wolf Knapp, author of New Orleans Beer. Fleur de Lit and Pearl Wine Company present Reading Between the Vines, Wednesday, March 12th at 7:30 at Pearl Wine Company, 3700 Orleans Avenue. The theme this month is celebrations, and featured authors are Errol Laborde, Kit Wohl, Stephen Ray, and Kim Marie Voss. Author and musician Ned Sublett will preview material from The Mother of Slavery, The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry, written with Constance Sublett and forthcoming in 2015. That's Wednesday, March 12th at 7 in Metairie Park Country Day School's Weinman Auditorium. Patricia Brady discusses the food and historical context of a New Orleans classic, Dinner at Antoine's, Wednesday, March 12th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Her appearance is part of the Culinary Legacy Series hosted by Liz Williams, founder and president of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. And I'm looking forward to being a part of Reading New Orleans, a conversation with Susan Larson and Rebecca Snedeker, Thursday, March 13th in the Whitney Bank Room of Loyola's Thomas Hall on St. Charles Avenue. The event starts at 6 with a reception at 5:30. Today's guest, Richard Campanella, signs Bourbon Street, A History, Thursday, March 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Three local authors, Shane Finkelstein, M.A. Harper, and Patty Friedman, talk about their recently published books Thursday, March 13th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Hammond Regional Arts Center presents an all-day celebration of the written word, Saturday, March 15th, starting at 9 at the Hammond Regional Arts Center and other venues. Writers on hand include David Armand, Jack Bedell, Patricia Brady, Pamela Binnings-Ewan, Bev Marshall, Tim Gautreau, James Wilcox, and many others. I'll be there too. Check out HammondArts.org. Whitney Stewart signs her new picture book, A Catfish Tale, Saturday, March 15th from 11 to 12:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Dickens Fellowship discusses David Copperfield, chapters 43 to 49, Saturday, March 15th at 2 at Metairie Park Country Day School's Bright Library. Anita Dennis, a retired New Orleans educator, reads from and signs Reflections from the Porch, a collection of poetry and prose based on life experiences, observations, thoughts, and reflections, Saturday, March 15th at 2 at the Algiers Regional Library. Best-selling author Jan-Philipp Senker signs A Well-Tempered Heart, Saturday, March 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. Michael Patrick Welch signs New Orleans The Underground Guide, Saturday, March 15th at 9 at the Always Lounge. Poets Dave Brinks and John Sinclair present a full moon reading, followed by an open mic, Sunday, March 16th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Susan Choi is the Zale Kimmerling Writer in Residence at Tulane University this year. Her most recent book is My Education. She presents a reading and sits for an interview Monday, March 17th at 7 at Waldenburg Arts Center, Freeman Auditorium at Tulane University. The Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival is coming up fast, starting March 19th through 23rd. Don't miss authors like Emily Rabiteau, Victor Laval, Justin Torres, Hilton Alls, Megan Abbott, Laura Lippman, and performers like Diane Ladd and Judith Chapman, as well as today's guests, Richard Campanella and Blake Bailey. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for the complete schedule. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.